sheet? Okay, good, good, good. Then let's begin. Last time we introduced Megillat Rut, we talked about the story as a gripping story, and Rut and the way that she appeals to different people for different reasons. And we talked about the timeline of the book. It is sometime within Shoftim, the book of Judges, that period after the time of Yehoshua, but before the period of Shmuel and David HaMelech and King David and so on. We noted the possibilities within that time frame for when it could be, because that still narrows it down to a few centuries. We talked about the authorship being credited to Shmuel HaNavi, Shmuel the prophet, which raised questions that we have to address today. And the question was this: if Shmuel writes Megillat Rut, then number one, why isn't it in Nevi'im, the middle section of Tanakh? He was, after all, Rabban Shel Nevi'im. He is considered the greatest of the prophets, Moshe aside. So why isn't this in Nevi'im? And if you'll say that it was written with lesser holiness, then I'll ask, well, why? He's capable of more holiness. Why did he write it with lesser holiness? And number two, Shmuel is also the author of the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. The story occurs in the same time frame, and it's the same author. Why didn't he just put it in Sefer Shoftim, put it in the book of Judges? So that was what we started to discuss at the end last time, and it's what I want to focus on now for the introduction. I am going to come back to Ricky's question about why it's a Megillah. So, what is the meaning of being a Megillah? So, God willing, we'll get to that as well. But there's a lot to cover. So at the end last time, we said that books in Tanakh are generally recorded because they have lessons that are meant for us, whether they're lessons of, you know, histories that we learn how God deals with the Jewish people, or whether they're exhortations for us to be loyal to God, or whether they're about a time of Mashiach. There are also lessons that different books have. Well, what's the goal in canonizing Ruth? What lessons could be found here? And how will that affect where in Tanakh the book ends up? So I gave you a very brief outline of some ideas at the very end last time, but now we're going to really explore this. I'm going to offer three schools of thought overall. The first school of thought is that it's about the monarchy. Okay? The second school of thought is that it's going to be about God. And the third school of thought is that it's going to be about a very specific theme that the book addresses, which we're going to come back to. I'm holding that one. Those who have been in my classes before know that obviously the last one is the one I like most. But the first one is that it's about the monarchy. Two different approaches within this. First, simple, is that it's to support the monarchy by presenting David's great lineage. In order to understand this, we need a little bit of background. And this is going to be familiar to some, not so familiar to others, but it's really important to understand. If you take a look on your sheet at source number one, from the book of Devarim, the Torah says, Lo yavo amoni umoavi bikahal Hashem. Ammonite, Moabite, do not get to marry into the Jewish people. I should stress, this doesn't mean they can't convert. It means they can't marry. Okay? They're able to convert to Judaism, but they're not able to marry a Jew. In other words, they can convert to Judaism and they can marry another Ammoni or Moavi who converted to Judaism. This is not about extinction. This is not about excluding them altogether. Don't marry them. Why? Al devar asher lo kidmu eschem balechem uvamayim baderech b'teizchem mimitzrayim. Because when you left Egypt, they didn't greet you with bread and water. When you read that sentence, it throws off the chronology a little bit in our heads. It doesn't really mean when you left Egypt. It means when you were on your way into Israel. The Jews came out of Egypt, they went off into the desert, spent 40 years running around in the desert. At the end of the 40 years, they're on their way into Israel, they're coming up the eastern side of the Jordan River, of the Yarden, going from south to north. And they keep trying to cut west to cross the Jordan, and the tribes that live on the eastern shores of the Jordan will not allow them through. So they hit Moab, and Moab is not interested in letting them marry. I'm reading Ricky's line in the chat. Stop reading the chat, Torchina. Okay. We're not there yet. You can read source number two. So they're trying to go through, and they hit Moab. Moab is not going to allow them to cross through. And in fact, what Moab does instead is they hire this fellow Bilam to curse the Jews. And not only that, but at the end of the story with Bilam, the women of Moab and Midian try to seduce the Jews and lead them off into idolatry. So Moab is out. Parenthetically, our attempt to cross through the land of Moab is not presented explicitly in the book of Bamidbar. We only find it referenced in Devarim. For some of the other tribes, we're actually told about the approach to them, but not for Moab. But in any case, from that, because they didn't greet you with bread and water, the Torah says they're not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. I'm going to ask in general, like I ask all the time, please don't put questions to me in the chat. If you have a question, put it out loud, please. Unless your mic isn't working, that's a different story. The question that is there in the chat right now, the question of how does lo yavo bakahal, how does that mean that you're not supposed to marry? Lavo bakahal is a term for marriage specifically. To enter the kahal is a reference to marrying into. It's not a reference to conversion. There is no ban on anybody in the Torah converting, accepting Judaism, including the seven nations, including even Amalek. All of them are able to convert. Rebecca, you were going to say? Nope? Okay.
Doesn't that only apply to men?
So you're anticipating what Ruchama was anticipating, and it's in source number two. Right now, all I know is what the biblical text says. And it's true that the biblical text says males, but as a general rule in the Torah, the pronoun tends to be male. They tend not to spell out male and female. If you would have asked me without knowing the Gemara in source number two, my assumption would have been male, female, doesn't make a difference, all Moabites, all Ammonites are out. That would have been my assumption walking in. So take a look at source number two now. And I'm not going into all the background on this. For those who want more background on the story that's going on in this passage of Gemara, come to our Shmuel Shir on Thursday afternoons, because we've been learning all about Doeg, and we'll be learning more about Doeg over the next year or so probably, because we're in chapter 19, and he's a big player in chapters 19, 20, 21 in Shmuel. So the Gemara asks, and I'm going to read it in my English translation just in the interest of time, but you can see the original there. How do we know that a Moabite woman is allowed to marry a Jew? That's the context for this discussion in the Gemara in Yevamos. And the answer is because of a verse that is found when David defeats Goliath. When Shaul saw David going out to meet the Philistine, he said to the general Avner, "Whose son is this youth, Avner?" So the subtext to this, and what the Gemara understands is going on, is that he's not asking him literally, "Who is this kid's father?" Because after all, in Shmuel, in the previous chapter, in chapter 16, Shaul already met David. David is already playing music for him. He knows David's father is Yishai. Yishai even sent him a present. So we discussed this when we learned Shmuel in the Thursday afternoon shiur. We're not unpacking all the different approaches. The Gemara's approach is to say he knows full well who David's father is. The question is, what is David's lineage? Because Saul's daughter has been promised to the man who defeats Goliath. So he says, is this the guy who's appropriate for the monarchy? And Doeg of Edom, Doeg, who is Shaul's advisor, who is, as I put him in another context, Shaul's Yetzer Hara, he's the one who leads Shaul off in terrible directions. So Doeg of Edom says to him, "Before you ask about whether he is suitable for monarchy or not, ask if he is suitable to marry into the nation or not. He can't marry a Jew." Why? For he comes from Ruth of Moab. You have this woman, Ruth, from Moab. At that point, General Avner, who Shaul's been talking to, says to him, oh no, that's okay, he can marry in. We have learned what Ruchamah anticipated, what Joyce anticipated. Ammoni velo Ammonit, Moavi velo Moavit. The text says Ammoni and Moavi can't marry in. Those are males. Doesn't say anything about the women. The women, sure, they are allowed to marry in. And the text gives its reason for that. Why? Because the text says the problem was they didn't greet you with bread and water. And it is the way of men to greet, not the way of women to greet. Meaning, you have this foreign nation coming in, wanting to cross through the land. Did it dawn on you that the Ammonite and Moabite women were supposed to go out to greet the Jews? Obviously not. It was the males. So the males are the ones who failed, and therefore, the males are the ones who are banned. To which Doeg says, not so fast. The men should have greeted the men. And the women should have greeted the women. If your concern is that you think that the women, if your justification is that the women should have stayed back from this foreign nation, they could have greeted the women. So shades of the Dina story, Lirot Bivnot Haaretz. Nonetheless, Avner was silent. Avner has no answer. Doeg wishes to proclaim against David. He wants to declare David illegitimate. Immediately, a fellow by the name of Amasa, son of a man named Yitro HaYisraeli, who had wedded Abigail, daughter of Nachash. This is a quote from a different passage. And it's brought in here with a question. Amasa is named as the son of Yitro, but he's also, Yitro HaYisraeli, but he's also listed as the son of Yeter HaYishmaeli. Is it Yisraeli or Yishmaeli? So Rava said, it's because he girded himself with his sword like an Ishmaelite. This fellow Amasa stands up with his sword, and he says, anyone who does not heed this law shall be stabbed with a sword. This is my tradition from the court of Shmuel of Ramah. Ammoni, not Ammonit. Moavi, not Moavit. He says, this is the law, and if you have a problem with it, you're going to face my sword. And at that point, David is defended as legitimate. Now again, there's a lot going on in this story in terms of who Amasa is and who Doeg is, and the back and forth regarding David and his lineage is all fascinating. But the part that's germane for us right now is the assertion of David's legitimacy, but it is clearly controversial. I heard a comment before when we were starting on this source saying, it's only legitimized because of this situation. I would turn that a little bit. As I understand it, it's not so much that it's justified because of this situation, as that looking at the text of Tanakh itself tells us there has to be a justification. Because in Megillat Ruth, in the story of Ruth, Boaz, who is clearly, based on the book, we're going to see it, Boaz marries her, and no one says boo. And Boaz doesn't have any concerns, even though the text is filled with calling her the Moaviyah, the woman who came from the fields of Moab, and so on. The text is very clear. She's a Moabite. So the very fact that the text has no problem presenting her as a Moabite and having Boaz marry her tells me there must have been some kind of justification from which I understand, okay, it must be that this is legitimate. But it doesn't stop the challenge to David in a later generation, and this, according to this, the reason for recording Ruth in Tanakh is to say, look, Boaz did it. This is the way that, this is the way to understand it. Chana, you were going to say? Oh, I thought you unmuted. Okay. So this is Ibn Ezra in source number 3. He says, Babur Hayoz David Shoresh Malchus Yisrael, because David is the root of Israelite monarchy, Nichtav Bisifrei HaKodesh Yachas David. So we get his lineage here in the book. That's the idea. The only question I would ask at this point is why now? Why is this here in Megillat Ruth specifically? Let me frame this question actually a little bit differently. That's not the best way for me to frame it. Trying to think of the best way to frame it. I wrote something in my notes, but I want to do it a little bit differently. I think that there is something to be learned from the authorship of Megillat Ruth. I think this is the way that I would frame it. Professor Feivel Meltzer, the editor of the Dat Mikra edition of Megillat Ruth, who I quoted last week, points out that there are those who argue that if the goal of Megillat Ruth is to protect the lineage of King David, why don't we do better and simply bury the story? In other words, why does Tanakh tell me that David came from Ruth? If you had not given me Megillat Ruth, I wouldn't have known. Don't tell me this story. If you want to teach me Megillat Ruth and Boaz, right? Leave off the end. Leave off the part that marriage leads to David HaMelech. Leave out the part that it leads to King David. And then I don't even need to worry about Moavi and Lo Moavit and all of that. I never need to even worry about it. So I would respond, I see your hand, Ricky. I see you shaking your head, Susan. But I want to give a response which I think is very interesting in terms of understanding this. Shmuel wouldn't have seen it that way. First of all, in Shmuel's day, everybody knew where David came from. You know, nowadays, I wouldn't know. But in Shmuel's day, it's David is fourth generation from Ruth. Everybody knows who great-grandma is. That's number one. Number two, though, I think there's something else going on here. If you take a look at source number four, Rabbi Yeshua Bachrach wrote a series of books on Tanakh. And he has one called Ima Shel Malchut, Mother of Monarchy. So look what he has to say here. He says, Vayakam Shmuel Vayelech HaRamata. That pasuk, anybody remember where that pasuk is from?
It's after he anointed David.
Right. After Shmuel anoints David, in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tetzayin, the 16th chapter of Shmuel, we're then told Shmuel anointed David and he went home. So look at what Rabbi Bachrach says. Visham sagarat atzmo hanavi. There the prophet isolated himself. Vahi kimit bodeid im nafsho b'tsa'ar uva'achzava. He was like somebody who has had enough. Right? And remember, those who were there when we learned this in Shmuel, you see the distress that Shmuel is in having to anoint David. He resists when God tells him he has to do it, and God says, enough of your complaining, go anoint David. So he goes to anoint David, but he doesn't give him any special treatment. Whereas when he anointed Shaul, he talked to him about monarchy, he gave him all these messages and miracles. With David, pours the oil on his head, turns around, and goes home. So Rabbi Bachrach says he's you know, going off to seclude himself. He's had enough. V'ulay misham hit'orer v'katav et ha-megillah ha-yafah hazot. Perhaps from there he was awakened and he wrote this beautiful Megillah. U'misham shalach lo le-David et ha-bracha b'samui ki zeh sefer yichuso shel David. He sends David this blessing. Hidden, this is the book of David's lineage. In other words, this is Shmuel's attempt to protect David from the lineage challenge. He did nothing for David at the time. But then he writes Megillat Ruth as his contribution to the Davidic line. And I think that fits very well with the Gemara that we just saw in source number two. Who is the source for saying that the Moabite is okay? In source number two. Sorry, Chana, you're muted.
Shmuel.
It's Shmuel himself who is the one to say the Moabite women are able to marry in. He's coming back to protect the king he anointed. So this is one way to understand why Ruth is recorded. The purpose of recording Megillat Ruth and canonizing it in Tanakh is to say, King David's okay. Look, Boaz did it. Boaz was great. you clearly have a justification. It must be, and then we go on to our conclusion about Amoni, Amonit, Moavit, Moavit. Ricky, you were going to say.
Is there any commentary that suggests that perhaps Shmuel wrote the book? In other words, that he wrote something that perhaps wasn't, because we're talking about four generations ago. Is there a possibility that it didn't happen as he wrote it? Yeah, where is the love?
So, I wouldn't say that, no. I mean, I certainly won't see it in a traditional commentary, no. Aside from the fact that it's very consistent with Shmuel on the whole, I see no reason to suspect that. Susan?
Maybe I look at things a little more in the Peshat. But, to me, one of the beautiful things about our religion and our Torah that they're honest. They don't hide. We don't hide about Yaakov to his sons. We don't hide so many things of human nature.
Yeah.
And what is commendable, we don't pretend these things don't exist.
So what's your question?
It's not my question. It's my statement to what you said, you know, about the reasons that why did we put, why we could have hidden the whole book, but or the part about his lineage, but that's what makes us different. That's what makes the authenticity of Judaism, the truth of Judaism, is we don't do that.
Yes, we do.
State the truth.
Yes, we do. We like to say we don't. But don't kid yourself. There's an awful lot missing from our texts about the foibles of the figures we quote. You can't tell me that every mistake was recorded. You're right that we record certain things, but I wouldn't pretend that we're quoting, you know, that every story makes it into Tanakh. I think that there are times when it's useful and there are times when it's not useful.
But when it's in Tanakh, the reason is, I think, to just be honest with us.
I think the reason is when there's a lesson. I don't think it's about, I don't believe in the journalistic mantra, all the news that's fit to print. Or maybe I just have a different definition of what fit to print is. I think that there's an awful lot that is hidden, and I think it's hidden with reason. I don't think that there's value in simply portraying someone's flaws for the sake of portraying someone's flaws. It's where there's something to learn from it.
That's right. I agree, but I'm saying, but we do it for a reason. But
yeah.
We do it. Yeah, we don't say everything. If the books would be enormous, we couldn't do it.
They're already enormous, but yes.
But what we do is also to show that our great people are also human.
So I'm going to go a little further. I'm going to leave that point. A variation on the idea that it's about the monarchy is brought by Dr. Yael Ziegler. She suggests that it's not just about supporting the monarchy by giving David's lineage, but it's also about cementing the proper form of monarchy as coming about through the acts of Ruth and Boaz in Megillat Rut. I will tell you right now, something that we're going to have to come back to after Pesach, Dr. Ziegler is of the belief that Boaz is wonderful. We're going to see that there are two schools of thought on Boaz, but she is in the team Boaz camp, decidedly. So take a look, please, at source number 5, where I brought you a piece of an essay of hers, and I translated it for you. The English is on the next slide. Because there's a lot of text, again, I will read out my English, but you can see the original there as well. She first brings the idea that it's about David's line. Then she brings the idea that it's about chesed, an idea that I'm going to come back to, that we write the book because it teaches about chesed. We're going to come back to that. She has a different take. She says, one may say that the two different explanations for why we write the book blend well, and in practice they suggest a single approach to explaining the purpose of Megillat Rut. By this read, the goal of Megillat Rut is to justify the purity of David's lineage, accomplishing this by detailing the way that Ruth, the Moabite woman of this story, exemplified chesed. I've chosen not to translate chesed on this source sheet because the only translation I have for chesed is something along the lines of kindness and generosity, which is really awkward to write out. Just use the word chesed. Ruth, the Moabite woman of this story, exemplified chesed and involved herself in consistent and selfless giving to others. It is correct that Ruth's self-nullification is not something Judaism demands of every Jew. You don't have to nullify yourself the way Ruth does, saying, I'm just going to take care of my mother-in-law, I'm going to leave my land, and all of that. But it is a clear requirement when speaking of our leader, of the king. Not only do we expect this from our leader, but it is a prerequisite for establishment of the monarchy. Without Ruth at the helm, without someone who is equipped to give in a clear and selfless way to others, the monarchy is not a promise or vision of plenty, but a dangerous threat, a terrifying future, a recipe for lawlessness, corruption, and tyranny. So in other words, what she's getting at here is that the book of Ruth is there to show the proper monarchy. Now, parenthetically, she also has a piece that I didn't bring on here. Susan, I exclude things from the source sheet sometimes. It's not to hide anything, though. It's to save myself having to write a lot. But she also says that Ruth is included here to show that, look, Moabite women really are women of chesed, and therefore they shouldn't be included in the ban. That part I thought was a mistake, because Ruth is clearly presented as an exception to the Moabite women. She's not an example of what Moabite women are like. I think that's difficult. But
especially they did when Bnei Israel went out of Mitzrayim.
Also true. I find that part a little stretched. But but her main point here is that it's not just cementing David's legitimacy from a lineage perspective. It's cementing his legitimacy from a character perspective. This is his, so to speak, spiritual DNA that we're highlighting with this story. So that actually fits really well with some midrashim that I bring you here on the sheet. If you take a look at source number 6, and these are well-known midrashim, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but they're midrashim you hear about and you don't always read inside, and therefore I thought I would bring them here on the sheet just to remind you of them and so you could actually see them. The first one in source number 6 is the Medrash about the selection of David HaMelech, of King David, and of Moshe Rabbeinu. And in both cases, it's credited to the way that they take care of the sheep. They look after the sheep, and the famous story about Moshe taking the sheep that runs away and all that is there in the Medrash in source number 6. They care for the most vulnerable sheep. Therefore, they are the one who should be selected to lead the Jewish people. And then if you take a look at source number 7, you see it once again as well. It's the way that they take care of the vulnerable is what makes them eligible to lead. To which I would throw in one other source, and that's source number 8. Source number 8, it deals with a very controversial story. After Shaul is already dead, there are people of Gibeon who come to David and they want punishment for the descendants of Shaul. Well, they don't come to David. It's a whole story with a famine. I'm not going into the entire story. Let me make a long story short by saying David is going to punish the descendants of Shaul for what Shaul did to the people of Gibeon. And the Gibeonim demand that 7 of Shaul's descendants be killed. That's their demand. And take a look what the Gemara does with this. In source number 8, David tries to appease them. They won't be appeased. And he said, there are 3 signs for this nation, meaning for the Jewish people. Merciful, bashful, and generous. Right? Rachmanim, Baishanim, and Gomlei Chasadim. One who has these 3 signs is suited to cleave to this nation, and on this basis, the Gemara says, he drums out the Givonim. He says the Givonim cannot marry into the Jewish people. My point in bringing this is only just to show you David grabbing onto the character traits of Ruth. The three traits that David identifies as Jewish traits, the trait of being merciful, the trait of being bashful, and the trait of being somebody who performs chesed, all of those suit his great-grandmother Ruth. So he takes that as the hallmark of the Jew. Okay. I just bring that to show you her character showing up as valuable in the context of how we view David HaMelech, King David. So that's all one school of thought, which is Ruth's story is here in order to validate the monarchy. Validating it from a lineage perspective, validating it from a character perspective. Now I want to turn to a whole different way to look at this book. And that is that it's about God. And again, there are two parts. The first part is that it's how God rewards kindness. Take a look at source number 9, please. Someone quoted this last week, but we weren't ready for it yet. Amar Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira said, HaMegillah hazos ein ba lo tumah v'lo tahara. You don't find laws of purity and impurity in this book. Lo isur v'lo hater. You don't find laws about what's prohibited and permitted. The truth is there are mitzvot that show up in this book. We'll have to get to that when they show up in the story. That's Rabbi Zeira's statement, though. V'lo nichtefa ela lelamdecha kama matan sachar tov legomlei chasadim. The point is to show that God rewards those who engage in chesed. That's the point of the book. It's to teach me, not to teach me about chesed. If I want to know about chesed, I can just open up a chumash. This is an example of people who engage in chesed getting rewarded for it. That's why. It's a nice story in which all the things that we hope are going to come true actually come true. And Professor Meltzer supports this in his introduction to Megillat Rut. He points out the word chesed showing up in key places in this book. Naomi is going to thank Rut for the chesed that she displayed in Moab. Naomi is going to thank God for his chesed to the family. Boaz is going to thank Rut for her chesed for Naomi. And not only that, but also Naomi consistently points to God's oversight of events. Take a look at source number 10. This is from Professor Meltzer's introduction. He says, Kol ha-Megillah shofa'at emuna b'Hashem. He says, the entire Megillah flows with faith in God. U'bevada'ut hashkachato al olamo, and in the certainty that God oversees the world. Sheva pa'amim mavlita Naomi b'shnei ha-prakim ha-rishonim emuna zu. 7 times in the first 2 chapters, Naomi is going to express the faith that God runs everything. From the beginning when she says, when the famine ends in Beit Lechem, Pakad Hashem et Amo, God has taken care of his nation. All the way until when Ruth ends up in the field of Boaz, Baruch Hu Lashem Asher Lo Azav Chasdo. Blessed be God who did not abandon his chesed. It's not Boaz's chesed, it's God's chesed.
For is Naomi Jewish?
Naomi? Yeah. Yeah. If Naomi weren't Jewish, then we have another part of this story we'd have to explore. Yeah. So the whole book is about how not only is chesed conducted, but chesed is rewarded. It even bookends, right? In the beginning of the book, you have Ruth and you have Naomi who are impoverished, right? And then in the end, Ruth has she's married to wealthy Boaz. She has a child. She's stable and everything works out for her. Everything works out for Boaz as well, despite the fears of what is it going to do to his portion to marry Ruth. There's more in Dot Mikra. He really likes this idea. And frankly, this also fits what I think of as the real estate test. Some of you who learned Shmuel with me are familiar with this. When you want to know what a story is about, what it's really about, see where the real estate in the story goes. See how many verses are about different parts of the story. I did this, for example, in the story of David and Goliath. You have a chapter with over 50 verses in it. Only 3 are about the fight between David and Goliath. That's clearly not the point of the chapter. the other stuff going on that is the point of the chapter. In this book, the 85 verses, chesed and its reward get the most real estate. First, Ruth's chesed to Naomi is the dominant part of chapter 1, sentences 6 to 18. The entire chapter 2 is about chesed as Ruth gleans in the field of Boaz. The entire chapter 3 is the conversation between Ruth and Boaz in which she's going to end up marrying him. He commits to take care of her. And then in chapter 4 is the execution of that in sentences 1 to 12. That's what the book is about, from just looking at what's there. One other element that supports this idea of chesed specifically, and it's about God rewarding chesed, is pointed out again by Professor Meltzer. Take a look at source number 11. I really, really liked what he did here. He shows you the book of Ruth contrasted with the book of Esther. So we can connect our learning from Esther to our learning with Ruth. He says, Ha-havdalah ha-ikarit. He says the essential difference between the two books. He bazeh she-megilat Esther mechuvenet l'saper al ha-hashkacha ha-eliona ha-mesavevet as-hasibot po lamata. He says, Esther is all about how God puts things in place in order to make sure that what's supposed to happen next is going to happen next. So, getting rid of Vashti, getting Haman appointed, Mordechai finding out about Bigtan and Teresh, all those little pieces that have to be in place in order for the story to play out, God is doing them before the Jews have even appealed for help. Contrast that with Megillat Rut. B'Megillat Rut, Mar Eshe Ikara Bala Saper Ki Hashkacha Ha'Elyona Lamala Mashkicha V'Gomelet Gemul Mat'im Alanase Polamata. In Ruth, it's the opposite. God is not planning in advance. God is rewarding after the fact. We had to do that which was good. Ruth had to decide to come back with Naomi and take care of her in order for her to get the reward. The pieces in Esther, God is putting in the pieces in place beforehand. In Ruth, God is reactive, responding after the fact. I thought that was a very interesting idea. I don't think it's 100%, but it's pretty close. So within this perspective, the goal of Megillat Rut is to teach me about how God handles chesed, how God rewards, takes care of chesed. But again, I told you there are two parts to saying that this book is about what God does. The second part of it is that God takes care of those who remain loyal to God. If you're loyal to God, God will take care of you. And this thought was triggered for me by a piece from Dr. Noam Tzion from the Hartman Institute. He has a guide to Ruth called Chesed and Chutzpah, which I think is a good name, not just because of the alliteration. Take a look at source number 12. Moish, you're going to love this. He says, Chapter 1 of Megillat Ruth may best be called Megillat Naomi, for she is the central figure round which coalesce two levels, two related stages of tragedy, national and familial. Naomi is a kind of female Job whose relationship to God is deeply influenced by her suffering, though there is no explicit divine test stimulated by a Satan as in the case of Job, and Naomi is not billed as a tzaddik to be tempted. So he acknowledges there's some differences in the stories, but he says, look, she leaves her home in a time of famine. She loses her husband and she loses her kids and she loses her wealth. So he says, Naomi is a form of Job. I thought that was really fascinating. Where I break with Tzion, with Noam Tzion, not with Tzion, but where I break with Noam Tzion, is that he actually reads Naomi later on as protesting what God did to her. When she says, I left with everything and now I have nothing and God has done this, he reads it as a protest. I don't read it as a protest. I read it as tzidduk hadin. She's accepting what God did and saying, I earned this. This is what happened to me because I deserved it. And in that sense, what I actually see in this story, reading it as a Job type of message, is it's an antidote for Eob. It's an antidote for Job in the sense that Job loses everything and spends a lot of chapters screaming about it. We spent 2 years learning Job verse by verse. This is someone who loses everything and does not rebel at all. And instead, she comes home and is rewarded.
What did you mean by antidote? I didn't get that.
If you look at Job, if you read Job, you see that he suffers in this terrible way and he complains. He remains loyal to the end, but he calls God his enemy. God did this to me. He's very sharp. You don't see that with Naomi. And look, she gets a happy ending for it. Now, Job ends up with his own odd happy ending, depending on how you read the last chapter. We're not reviewing 2 years of Job right now. But my point is, in this, is simply to say, Joyce is saying, oh, thank you. The point here, I think, is to say, not only is this book about God rewarding chesed, it's about God rewarding those who remain loyal to God. So that's a second approach to why Ruth is here. But I want to give you a third approach. Third approach is mine. Take it for what it's worth. And then once we've seen all three of these approaches, we're going to come back to the question of why this is in Ketuvim and why it's not in Shoftim. I see another theme that's very dominant here, and this book in its place in Tanakh, and that is the theme overall of loyalty and betrayal on a personal level and on a national level. It underlies much of what's going to happen in this book, the relationships between every major figure as well as between God and the Jews. Can you give me an example of either loyalty or betrayal in this book? Right. So Ruth and Orpah at first trying to stay with Naomi, that's a loyalty example. Good. What else?
Disloyalty with the redeemer.
The first redeemer choosing not to redeem. Right. So you have the loyalty of Boaz, the betrayal by Ploni Almoni. You have leaving Israel, Elimelech's family, abandoning their city, apparently even though they had means. You have betrayal there. What else? You have Elimelech's sons marrying Moabite women, right? Which is portrayed in Tanakh as a clear element of betrayal in Malachi and elsewhere. We're going to come back to it. You have God's loyalty to the Jews, as Naomi puts it, in ending the famine. You have Ruth and Orpah and staying with Naomi when they're still in Moab, meaning when their husbands died, they stayed with her before she came back to Israel. That in and of itself was identified as chesed. Naomi thanked them for their chesed just in staying with her in Moab. Ruth going to glean is an act of loyalty to Naomi, and the farmer's loyalty in supporting their brethren. You have God's loyalty to Naomi's family in leading them to food with Boaz, as Naomi thanked God for this kindness. You've got loyalty, loyalty, loyalty throughout the book, except when you're seeing betrayal. Moish, I see your hand. I'll get to you. This is a very important theme in Tanakh overall. The book of Shoftim has that as a major theme. Which tribes will help other tribes? Which tribes will not? Those who learned Shimshon with me will recall that Shimshon's story is rife with themes of loyalty and betrayal, both directions. The book of Shmuel, the book of Malachim, David's loyalty to Shaul, the loyalty of other people to David, the layers of betrayal in David's own family and among his allies, his generals. I mean, you could go on forever just about that. in Yeshayahu, in Yirmiyahu, in Treyasar, you have loyalty and betrayal in our relationship with God and among the nation. And particularly at a time when the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the Great Assembly, are canonizing Tanakh, you have a major message in that era about the intermarriages of their time. Take a look, please, at source number 13 from the prophet Malachi. Malachi is criticizing the Jews of his day, the men who are marrying the Canaanite women. And he says, Hachad lechulanu. He says, we have one father. Halo kel echad bra'anu. Oops, that's Shemos. For anyone who printed this out, God's name is there. I missed that. Not sure how I missed it, but I did. He says, we have one father. One God created us. Madua nivgad ish be'achiv lechalel bris avosenu. Why does one man betray his brother, desecrating the covenant of our ancestors? And he goes on to describe this betrayal and treason of Jewish men who are marrying Canaanite women. So in this era, when they're canonizing Tanakh, they're very concerned about loyalty versus betrayal. And so to me, the Knesset HaGdola look at this and say, here's a lesson in morality, in terms of loyalty and its rewards, and betrayal and what happens to those who betray. It even shows the fulfillment of Malachi's predictions about the destruction of those who betray. I brought you the Radak in source number 14, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to read it out loud. You can see it there for yourself. But this, to me, is a third theme in the book, a third reason for recording the book. Yes, it teaches me about David's, it validates King David from the perspective of lineage and character. Yes, it teaches me about how God relates to the Jews in terms of the reward for chesed and the reward for being loyal to God. But I think it's also a story overall about loyalty and betrayal.
But is there consistent rewarding of loyalty and punishment for betrayal?
In Book of Ruth, yes. Overall in life, that's a lot harder.
In Shoftim?
Yeah, Shimshon's story is a perfect example. I think so.
But can we take that lesson for our own lives?
No. It becomes a lot harder to diagnose in our lives. That's why it's here in Tanakh. So I want to come back to the question of why Ruth is not in Nevi'im and why Ruth is not in Shoftim. Maish, can you hold off? Or is it about something we said already? Okay.
No problem. Just hold off. No problem.
Okay, thank you. So in terms of why Ruth is not in Nevi'im, Don Isaac Abarbanel wrote a long introduction to Nevi'im. It appears in the beginning of his commentary of the book of Yoshua. And he discusses this question as part of his introduction to Nevi'im. And he says he has technical reasons for why Ruth does not appear in Nevi'im, why it's in Ketuvim, why it's in the writings. I brought it for you in source number 15. I'm going to read out my English translation. He says, he's talking about Shmuel as the author. And he says, Shmuel did this himself. It's Shmuel's decision to write Megillat Rut in David's honor and to tell of his lineage without any divine command. There was no instruction from God to go write this. And he did not communicate what he wrote here from God prophetically, but according to knowledge that was accepted with them. So Shmuel, he says, writes this not prophetically. He's writing down the traditions they had. Our sages accepted that it was written with divine inspiration, but not with prophecy. Therefore, they placed it among the writings according to the level of inspiration with which they believed it was composed. He says, number one, there was no divine command to write it. It was just a recording of traditions. That's number one suggestion from Abarbanel. Number two, he says, I have a second reason, which is that even if we would agree that Ruth was on the level of the book of Judges, it was composed prophetically upon divine command and via divine information like the other books of the prophets, still, Shmuel's intent with this composition was David's honor, as I have written. And therefore, our sages saw fit to join it with the book of Psalms, which David wrote, to inform of his lineage. To enable that juxtaposition, It was placed in the writings even though its level was prophetic. In other words, it's ink to Vim so that it can appear next to Tehillim. We want it next to Tehillim to justify David. And he says, look at the Gemara in Bava Basra. The order of the writings is supposed to be Ruth and then Tehillim. That's not the way it appears in the Tanakh of ours. That's the way the Gemara has it. Ruth, Tehillim, and then Eov, Mishle, and so on. They placed Ruth at the head for the reason I have stated. Not for chronology purposes, he says, but rather to be beside the Psalms of David, her descendant. His descendant? Oh, because it's Boaz, that's why. The story of Boaz, who beside the Psalms of David, his descendant. So that's a Barbanel. But I think based on what we've said about the purpose of the book, it makes perfect sense for it to be in Ketuvim. Because fundamentally, it's a pedagogic book. It's a teaching book. It's not a prophetic message from God. It teaches us about the monarchy of David using a story. It teaches us about our relationship with God via a story. It teaches us about loyalty and betrayal via a story. It's a teaching book. It's meant as that kind of story. And therefore it fits in the Ketuvim, in the writings. It's not being presented as a prophet speaking to us and in that mode. In terms of why it's not in Shoftim, though, and here I really like the following idea. Abarbanel gives me, again, technical reasons for why it's not in Shoftim. Abarbanel says in source number 16, I'm not going to read it inside in the interest of time, but he says, Shoftim is meant to record national events, and this is a story about a family. It's a big family, it's an important family, but it's a family. Shoftim, all the stories are very large. Now, you could argue Shimshon, but that's his, that's what he says. And number two, he says, when Shmuel wrote Ruth, he had already finished writing Shoftim. If I had to rank least convincing things Abarbanel ever said, this would be somewhere up there. Really? I mean, it was off to the publisher? Like what? I don't know what that means. That's what he says. But
how did he know that?
I don't know. Except that, I'll tell you how he knows it. He knows it because maybe he's adopting the idea that Rabbi Bachrach proposed, that Shmuel went home and did this after. Maybe. But I think there's a more fundamental point. It makes sense to separate these books. Those who learn Shoftim with me, tell me, what's one word that captures the book of Shoftim? No, one word in English.
Mayhem.
Mayhem is one. Failure. Shoftim is one big, epic fail. It is a depressing spiral. The Jews lack a central authority to guide them to Torah. They sink into Canaan-style barbarity. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong. Things that shouldn't possibly go wrong go wrong. It's awful. It's awful. Whereas the message of Megillat Rut is the opposite. It's aspirational. It's what a monarchy can be, right? It's God rewarding chesed. It's God rewarding faith. It's God rewarding loyalty. It's the opposite of Shoftim. This book doesn't belong in Shoftim. It would break. What would you do? Shoftim and Rut may happen at the same time, but their messages are diametrically opposite. Shoftim is about how bad things can get. Ruth is about how wonderful things can get. They don't belong together. You can't put them in the same book.
I would argue that you could, because the contrast would even highlight Shoftim and failure. I don't know.
Okay. I stand by my point. Moish, you waited very patiently. Uh-oh, lost him. So now I get to answer Ricky's question then. Ricky asked, what is the meaning of calling this book a Megillah? So the word Megillah is understood to mean a self-contained scroll, something which is an entire unit and is therefore written on its own. If you take a look at source number 17 on the sheet, you'll see the Gemara in Gittin, which asks a question about whether I'm allowed to write parts of the Chumash, on a scroll in order to use it to teach children. And the Gemara says, this is a question, and it talks about the question of when the Chumash was given to us, was it all given to us lump sum at the end of being in the wilderness, or was it given to us in separate scrolls as things happened? Megillah, Megillah. The word Megillah means a self-contained scroll. Similarly, I brought you Rashi on a book called Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit is a scroll going back to the time of the Mishnah that lists what days on the Jewish calendar you're not allowed to fast because special things happened on those days. And it's called Megillat Ta'anit, says Rashi in source number 18, because it was written as its own standalone scroll, separate from anything else. So take a look at source number 19, in which I'll show you that Masechet Sofrim, which is post-Gemara, but not by a lot, tries to give us the list of the Megillot, and it says, Ruth, Shir HaShirim, Kohelet, Eicha, and Esther. These are the Megillot, and when you read them, you say a bracha of Al Mikra Megillah, even though they appear in Ketuvim. Whereas if you were to have a ritual reading from Ketuvim, other parts of Ketuvim, you would say a bracha Likro B'Kitvei HaKodesh. We don't actually have that, but there is such a concept. The reason I bring it to you is to show you that these five books are identified early on as being unique, separate, discrete units. There's more I could bring on this, but I figured I wasn't going to have time, and I was right, so that's fine. But in answer to your question, Ricky, of what does it mean when we call it a Megillah, the answer is it's its own self-contained unit, which is, you know, even written in its own scroll. Okay. We did a lot today, and I kind of rushed it, but I hope that it was still clear. Chana, you were going to say? Yep. So,
I wanted to ask, isn't it in Targum Shivim that it comes after Shoftim?
So yes, in Targum Shivim, it is still found side by side with Shoftim. That is correct. And the early Christians, as a result, insisted that it should be side by side with Shoftim because they worked from the Septuagint, which had that order. I don't know if Targum Shivim did, but Septuagint does. They're not really the same thing. So what we've seen then, now, having done our introduction, is we have a sense of the story itself. We have some details about it being a Megillah, some details about the timeline and when it took place and the messages. And then after Pesach, God willing, we're going to jump right into the story. And my opening question is going to be, why did Elimelech and Naomi leave Israel? What was their motive for leaving? We're probably familiar with the classic midrash about them not wanting to support the local people in Beit Lechem during the famine. We'll talk about where that comes from, and then we'll proceed from there. Rucham, I see you have Rav Bachrach's book.
Yes.
You have Ima Shel Malchut. Excellent. It's a good read.
So do I.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Everybody should have a happy, a healthy, a kosher